You could say, well, she would say that, wouldn't she? After all, it's easier to blame the internet. But what if it's true? What if a coordinated online campaign did ramp up the hate against Amber to the point where a jury simply couldn't avoid it? One of the things I find weird about the Depp case is that for all the money and attention thrown at it, no real effort has gone into trying to answer this question. There are rumours about bots, about trolls, about organised campaigns, but it's all conjecture. Lots of it's no light. So, okay, if this is a movie, it's got my attention. I'm convinced by this point that it's a story worth digging into, a story that could be much bigger than the celebrities in the middle of it. I want to know who trolled Amber. But that's jumping the gun. First, I have to show that bots and trolls were used against her in the first place, that it wasn't just real-life Johnny Depp fans giving her shit. And maybe if I work out what happened, I can find some clues about who might have been behind it. So I start at the beginning. I look through thousands of pages of court documents filed in both the UK and the US. I'm looking for any mention of bots, and they're not difficult to find. There's a deposition given by Amber's agent.
Just as I would go through, you know, daily, just looking at comments or accounts that just had, you know, no followers, no posts, nothing, or following just Amber and Johnny, they weren't consistent with what I know to be actual Instagram accounts.
And this email sent by her publicist.
Our company with 3,000 followers gets killed consistently on Instagram when we post about Amber. There has to be an algorithm that they follow. I've clicked on many of those making obscene comments, and they all seem to be bots.
Jen had also told me about a counterclaim filed by Amber against Johnny. A counterclaim is a claim against someone who has already brought a legal action against you. Amber files her counterclaim as part of the US proceedings. She submits it in 2020, a few months after Depp sues her. Basically, from that moment, the couple are suing each other. In her counterclaim, Amber alleges that Depp's team created, coordinated, controlled, and/or manipulated social media accounts specifically for the purpose of targeting Miss Heard. In other words, it accuses Depp of orchestrating a bot campaign against her. But this part of the counterclaim is problematic. As evidence of this supposed campaign, Amber's lawyers lynch of Twitter accounts that they say are bots. But when I look at some of these accounts online, I find that many seem to be real people. I feel pretty certain that the counterclaim gets a lot of stuff wrong. And it seems to have confused Depp's superfans, people obsessed enough with the actor to post 20 or 30 times a day, with bots. So I'm not surprised when I discover that a judge dismissed Amber's claim about bots for lack of evidence more than a year before the US trial. And that decision turns out to be critical. Because from the moment that that part of the counterclaim is dismissed, the issue of bots is off the table. When the trial starts at Fairfax County Court in Virginia, and Amber's witnesses eventually take the stand, they aren't even allowed to talk about bots or a bot campaign, because by then, the issue has already been decided in Depp's favour. And that left me wondering, did any of Amber's witnesses suspect that a bot campaign had occurred, but just couldn't say? Does any evidence exist that wasn't presented at trial?
Be seated, your next witness.
We call Ron Schnell.
Okay.
Schnell. S-C-H-N-E-L-L.
Thank you, sir.
I go through Amber's witness list, and there's one name that stands out. Ron Schnell. Ron is a computer expert from Miami. His speciality is social media forensics.
I do software projects and manage software projects and architect them. But I also do things like this, where I'm consulting in litigation and sometimes testifying in litigation.
He tells the court that he's analyzed huge numbers of tweets posted against Amber Heard, but he only testifies on a relatively narrow point about whether or not anti-Amber tweets went up whenever Depp's lawyer, a guy called Adam Waldman, accused her of faking her abuse claims. By the time the case goes to trial, that narrow question, the thing about the lawyer, is the only part of Amber's counterclaim against Depp that hasn't been struck out. But I wonder, does Ron Schnell know more than he was letting on?
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Ron. How are you?
Well, thank you.
In March last year, I give him a call.
Although the judge did throw out the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim, I had already done a lot of work relating to it. So this whole question of were there bots, was there an orchestrated campaign, was something I did look into, just never got to see the light of the trial.
Ron explains that when he came onto the case, one of the first things he did was download a whole bunch of tweets which were critical of Amber Heard. We're talking almost a million posts, gigabytes worth of data.
I actually used something called Botometer. There's a web version where you can just give it a Twitter handle and it'll tell you whether it thinks it's a bot or not. I fed in hundreds of thousands of anti-Amber Heard tweets and got a lot of data from that.
But his work stopped when the judge threw out most of Amber Heard's counterclaim, that the jury never heard anything about Ron's data. Ron won't go much further on the phone. He needs to check what he's allowed to tell us.
If I were to ask Amber Heard's legal team for their permission to disclose your work in this area, would you be happy for me to look at it?
Sure.
That's really helpful. Thank you.
I feel like I have my first lead. Ron still has his huge database of tweets, hundreds of thousands of anti-Amber messages, perfectly preserved. Within that data might be patterns, networks, links that reveal which accounts were working together. If I can pick up where Ron left off, I might be able to learn about what happened to Amber Heard, who might have been responsible, and the ways we're all being manipulated online. Next time on Who Trolled Amber, we go to Miami to see Ron.
It appears to be some sort of organized attack.
We speak to a Hollywood insider.
She couldn't get an audition, and no one would hire her.
And we learn about disinformation from an emu.
Emmanuel, leave it alone. Emmanuel, don't do it!
We contacted Johnny Depp while making this podcast, but he didn't respond. Thank you for listening to Who Trolled Amber. Who Trolled Amber is written and reported by me, Alexi Mostras, and by Xavier Greenwood. The producer is Xavier Greenwood. Additional reporting by Katie Riley. Sound design is by Carla Patella. The narrative editor is Gary Marshall. The editor is David Taylor.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Peter Menzies, senior fellow with the McDonald Laurier Institute, former newspaper past vice chair of the CRTC. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Glad to have you here, Peter. Today on the show, I fought the Loblaw, and the Loblaw reported record profits. Also, we will take a step back and look at the state of the CBC, the CRTC, the whole CanCon broadcast apparatus after years of efforts to modernize. It is a mess. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news.
Well,
born on the Reddit thread, Loblaws is out of control. A movement to boycott its stores for the month of May is picking up steam.
Anywhere but Loblaw. That's the nationwide call against the grocery behemoth and all the different brands under its umbrella across the country.
Not just Loblaws, as you know, but superstores, value marts, independent grocers, wholesale clubs, Zehrs, Provigo, Dominion, on it goes, even Shoppers Drug Mart.
Our community felt that it was not the only problem.
Asking for a reduction in prices of 15% and removal of member-only pricing.
But will avoiding Loblaw stores for the month of May make a difference to one of Canada's biggest grocery retailers? Experts say probably not immediately.
Peter, have you been following this boycott of Loblaws, Loblaw, the Loblaw Empire?
Sort of, but it's been kind of on the fringes of my attention. The food industry isn't a great area of my expertise, but I find it kind of interesting to watch.
Everybody's got to eat. Everybody's got to buy their food somewhere. And this is something, you know, we're in the middle of the month of the Boycott Loblaws campaign. There was a steal something from Loblaws Day on May 12th. Did you steal anything from Loblaws on May 12th?
I did not.
So you claim.
And I wouldn't tell you if I did.
Good. We could keep some secrets on the show. You know, this is something that Loblaws has said is incredibly unfair. Galen Weston has said that as a well-known company and Canada's largest grocer, it is natural that Loblaw would be singled out as a focal point for media and government and, of course, consumer frustrations. But we're not doing anything differently than anybody else, was his point. And I think that is true, and I profoundly don't care.
Hi, I'm Galen Weston. Across the country, the way Canadians buy their food is changing. If you've got a suggestion, a complaint, whatever, let us know. Because sometimes a lot of little things can add up to something pretty big.
So we invited you to a barbecue, said you're going to have to make your own food.
How about sharing a bit of that?
Can we have some pretzel buns over here, please?
Just don't expect any leftovers this year.
We're definitely not a zombie company.
I am very comfortable with Galen Weston and Loblaw being singled out for the egregious level of monopolization. They do control 27% of the market share of Canadian grocery sales, but of course it goes beyond that. We've been talking about this since 2020. They, of course, also own Shoppers Drug Mart. They own all these sub-brands. For a lot of people in Canada, it's not really a level of consumer choice. You know, you really don't have any option. I've gotten frustrated with them as a consumer from time to time and just said, you know, I can take my business elsewhere and just invariably find myself back there. Peter, I don't endorse any particular movement or campaign as a journalist, but I express my opinions about these things. And I do feel like just as like a market force, as like a vector of power, the Canadian consumer, it's like a divide and conquer thing. Our buying power is, it's not a power that we flex much or that we find ourselves consolidating and exercising. So I've been watching this with great interest, but, you know, the Star reports that while people on this Reddit community that are organizing this are like taking pictures of like what they claim are empty parking lots and saying we're having an impact, and then anonymous supposed Loblaws employees are saying, oh yeah, our profits are way down here, take it from me. The company itself says that this is not hurting sales. The grocer's share price just hit a new high. It almost feels like they're gloating, like you can't hurt us.
It's kind of a typical Canadian thing where people suddenly notice that there's a lack of competition. I mean, the protests might be better focused on outside the Competition Bureau, right? And the government agencies that allow for these sort of structures to evolve in terms of that, the people who approve the takeovers and that sort of stuff. In a sense, you can't blame a company. If you're running a company, you're trying to make money, you're going to try to expand, right? You're going to try to expand your market share and add value for your shareholders. We might not like that, but that's the way the world works, right? If the government wants more competition, it needs to create better competition laws and a better atmosphere for investment for others. So I have no idea. I'm like most people. I don't know if I'm shopping at a Loblaws owned place or not. I didn't even know that they own Shoppers Drug Mart until you just mentioned it right now.
That's kind of a problem, though.
I'm a little over 55, so I go to Shoppers every Thursday for 20% off Seniors Day. But I think that's probably where most consumers are at. You want me to join a boycott, but I'm just not convinced that boycotting your source of food, whether you like it or not, is really the best strategy. This is non-discretionary spending. It's not like I'm going to boycott the Blue Jays because they are playing badly and I'm not going to buy tickets for this month. It's a really problematic area.
Well, Peter, I hear you that the kind of grown-up approach to this, one might say, is to say, you know, like, let's look for policy solutions. We obviously have an antitrust problem. If people want to speak up as citizens, they can demand legislation from our completely ineffectual Competition Bureau. I can't see how it helps Canadians to have one mega corporation in charge of that much, 27% of our food, also pharmaceuticals moving into privatized healthcare. Loblaws Financial had this tax dodge in the Caribbean. They fixed the price of bread, for God's sake. So this is a problem, and we might say that Canadians would be better off asking the government to step in, maybe even to destroy the supply management system that makes Canadians pay more for milk and butter and these essentials than Americans pay.
Yep.
Let me get into this a little bit because, you know, I have a disclosure to make here, Peter. I say at the end of every episode, I read everything you send. That's not entirely true. I do read everything that people write about Canada Land and email in. And I also, to tell the whole truth, read everything that people write about Canada Land that they don't send in, as long as they publish it publicly. So there's a Canada Land Reddit. And I'll digress a little bit here. In the world of Reddits, especially for podcasts or things like that, usually it's like people who like the podcast go and form a Reddit to talk about the podcast. The Canada Land Reddit seems to be exclusively people who shit on Canada Land, which I think is just exactly on brand. The biggest supporter of Canada Land, who gives us money every month and has a tote bag and really thinks, would probably not describe themselves as a fan. Like we're not like Taylor Swift or like an indie rock band. We don't want to have fans. So I think that our Reddit probably should be people who shit on us. But I read them all. I'm there lurking. Here's what I read. Canada Land's silence on the Loblaws boycott is deafening. Hard to think Jesse isn't connected or a stockholder at this point. What? What? Who are these people? I mean, people imagine that the world is divided into like the millionaire from Monopoly and then like, I don't know, the rebels from Les Miserables. And that's the only two types of people who... No, I'm okay with shitting on Loblaws. We've been doing it for years. I just feel like they got to get more creative than just boycotting. I think, Peter, you're right. Like, people need to eat a lot of... It's a privilege to be able to go shop somewhere else that not everybody has. So I'm not endorsing anything, but I am saying if you want media attention, if that's what this is about, why is Canada Land not covering this? We can only cover a boycott once. Like, what is there to say? The story has to move. Don't boycott when you can sabotage. Follow me here, Peter, for a moment. I urge people to just be a bit more creative with their opposition. So we've been shooting around ideas around the office. You could go to a no frills and adorn it with many fanciful frills, you know, gold inlay or stained glass, beaded curtains. Open up the organic free range eggs, you know, like those $9 eggs, and just like swap them with the $2 eggs, you know, undermine confidence in eggs. Host a murder mystery party in the meat department aisle. What if you had like guerrilla farmers markets out in the parking lot so people actually had an option, and then you put Loblaws in the position of like, what, are you going to go break up this farmers market? What else? You could stage a flash mob at the self-checkout. Perfectly legal. Is this any of this working for you, Peter?
Well, the problem with all of it, like we said earlier, it's a food store, right? So almost anything you can think of gets between your fellow citizens and their food and the efficiency of their day, which it disrupts the consumer more than it does Loblaws. If you want to raise the issue of Loblaws, if you want to go after them and fight its dominance in the market and that sort of stuff, you know, knock yourself out. But I think the boycott is just a really bad idea that doesn't appear to be well thought out. I don't think they're really looking for media attention. They're looking for allies, right? They're looking for people to promote their cause, because otherwise, if you're looking for media attention, you can get media attention, but, you know, don't confuse fame and notoriety. If you want to just lay down and glue yourself to the floor in a Loblaws store, go ahead. But all you're going to do is piss off fellow shoppers who are trying to get down that aisle, and you've friggin' glued yourself to the floor in it or something like that.
Yeah.
I just don't see the boycott as being a sensible tactic to the achievement of the goal.
You're not going to hurt the people you're trying to hurt, is what you're saying. And you know, that, it came, like, as we're kind of thinking of these things, you know, who ultimately does this annoy or frustrate? These are desperate measures, and I think they are indicative of just a broad failure of policy that we're in this situation to begin with. I want to see the consumer getting more powerful in this country. Like, I really do feel like in the business deal between our different institutions, organizations, companies, we matter, or we should. And I think that we've just been divided and conquered. I like the creative energy that goes into some of these videos and the content that's coming out of this boycott of people saying, like, in certain malls, they'll go and take a product in a Shoppers and then go walk to another store in that mall and show it for, like, a third of the price. There's one Redditor who suggested that they develop a price check app, a price comparison app, where you can immediately find out if somebody is offering the same thing at a cheaper price than Loblaws. That kind of, like, information warfare appeals to me more than these kind of direct actions. But, I mean, certainly just not shopping there is an option everybody should have. Like, part of the reason for a boycott is the impossibility of the boycott. Because it's impossible for so many people to boycott Loblaws is why we need to have a boycott of Loblaws.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you can take that point. But you see it everywhere in Canadian society. I mean, look at your telcos. Your cable companies, right? You've got 3-4 companies owning 70-80% of the market in some of those areas, that sort of stuff. It's almost comical in the sense that it's almost a Canadian tradition. It's like we've been so protectionist, you know, foreigners, by which we mean Americans, into the country, those companies to compete with us, that we sort of set up these big oligopolies as sort of national institutions. So Bell or Rogers and the telco side, or in this side, Loblaws, you're talking about, well, God bless them. Mm-hmm. You know, they're a nice, big, powerful Canadian company, and they're protecting us from those Americans, right? And now we have control over our own industry. Oh. And you can think that, and you can feel good about it, but you pay a price for it because you create these oligopolistic structures that aren't very consumer-friendly.
Peter, it's your first time joining us. We like to duly note things that we think people should pay more attention to. I'm going to start us off. It's not necessarily that it was undercovered, but there was an aspect of Rex Murphy that I think got overlooked. You know, Rex Murphy, the pundit, most recently for the National Post, is somebody who frequently was criticized on this program. He is also somebody who we covered in the early days of Canada Land. I reported the fact that this guy was receiving money from the oil and gas industry as a paid speaker while opining about them. So I don't know what he thought about us. Nothing great, I assume. But I'm not bringing him up to speak ill of the dead, though there was plenty of that on social media. There was also a lot of glorification and hagiography as if he was... I'm not a fan of his later work, but what I want to duly note here is just how interesting and different and refreshing Rex Murphy was when he first hit the scene. I want to play a bit of audio in which a very young Rex Murphy, not as a broadcaster, but as a commentator on a CBC piece about the death of the fishery in Newfoundland.
Sons of my age are absolutely no interest and no taste for the type of life that fishing is, getting up at 5 in the morning and going out and freezing literally to death for the early hours, and then depending on what was given. Fishing is by no means a planned activity. You don't plan the way of the waves. And this really, I mean, the fishing way of life is probably the one dominant trait in the whole perspective of Newfoundland living. It is. What fishing demands of you is that you do wait for circumstance and that you do submit to circumstance. And that type of insecurity, which bred, I think, the most magnificent sense of self-reliance, you know, is absolutely aesthetic, has died. Newfoundland is no longer a fishing community, and I don't think, as one arrogant opinion to a thousand others, that it ever will be.
So our listeners can hear that. What we can see there is a young Rex, and he's smoking a cigarette, and he's rather eloquent, and he has a certain magnetism. He's kind of staring off as he puts these thoughts together. And reading up on young Rex Murphy, he fought for free tuition was promised to young Newfoundlanders, and then it was sort of revoked and only given for first year, and he successfully pushed Smallwood to extend it to all throughout your education, post-secondary. So there's things he did that don't seem congruent with who he was later in life, but I'm moved by just, hey, look at this guy. And he kind of burst into a Canadian media scene where everybody looked very generic and everybody sounded very generic. And he was very regional, very specific, and a very unique face, and not an unappealing looking. Like he has a certain kind of a great looking guy in his own kind of off kilter way. And it's just quite something to compare that to the pundit of his later years. I feel like his career outlived his curiosity. But I don't like the kind of victory dance that some people have been taking. This guy contributed to the Canadian public conversation in a really unique way for a very long time.
Yeah, he did. And I thought it was a glorious career. Everybody goes through phases in their thinking in their life, or, you know, at least they should. I think if you're not changing your opinions and views on things over the course of time, you're not thinking hard enough, because there's always going to be things that change that. I made his acquaintance a couple of years ago in Toronto when we were both going to the same event, and the organizers had his driver come by and pick me up. So I got to spend 45 minutes each way chatting with him, and I found him to be very personable, very curious about me in that case, or whoever was with him, very private at the same time. But it was a long career. I mean, he was part of the same cohort at Oxford as Bill Clinton.
Oh, wow.
He was a Rhodes Scholar, and Clinton was going there, so he's part of that gang. The thing I found most appealing about him throughout this space were two things. One was his cultural uniqueness and having that Newfoundland voice, because there's two places in Canada. Well, there's lots of places in Canada that are unique, but there are two places where you could be in a different country when you go to them. I mean, culturally unique in Canada, one's Quebec, and the other's Newfoundland.
Yep.
I mean, it's a fabulous, very interesting place from a cultural point of view. But so he stuck up for that, which, you know, he was sticking up for the little guy in a sense like that. I think in his own mind, in his later years, he was sticking up for the little guy. The audience he believed he was writing for was the working men and women of Canada, right? And I think that made him not unique among journalism, but I think that was part of his contribution because, okay, I'll say it, I think a lot of journalists just write for themselves or for their buddies. I think the Parliamentary Press Gallery and Legislative Press Galleries, in my experience, the crowd they're writing for is the crowd that they go to the bar with, that they have coffee with, that they hang around with, and they're not necessarily writing for their readers or talking for their listeners or for their viewers. And I think he made a great contribution. I mean, his Cross Canada checkup stuff he was fabulous on that. Like, you couldn't have had a better guy for that. Nothing against Ian Hanna-Mansing, but he was great at that.
Rest in peace to Rex Murphy.
Duly noted.
Peter Menzies, that is Shortcuts. Great talking with you. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure.
I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send and more. Peter, where can people find you and your work?
They can find me on Twitter at PAGMenzies. They can find me on Substack. I have a new Substack called The Rewrite, which is a sort of weekly roundup of journalism done badly and lessons that can be learned from it.
Reading that and stealing ideas from it. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you for supporting Canada Land.
Hey, this is Anuki, your Faculty of Environment representative, here to let you know what the SFSS is. The SFSS is a student union that is student-led, and it represents and advocates for the interests of the 26,000 undergraduate students at SFU. We are a non-for-profit support network and a voice at SFU, which provides services like the UPass and health and dental. We also provide support to make your student life better. You can reach the SFSS on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or by emailing us. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.